topic today is going to be rational thinking, responsible feeling. I am a Lutheran minister, a marriage and family counselor, and also a chemical dependency counselor. Some of the things that I'll be presenting later on in the week will be on emotions and feelings, chemical dependency, codependency, many of those general kinds of topics. I tend to leave the headier, intellectual, theological things up to the educators and the theologians in the group. And so if you're expecting to get a heavy theological presentation today, you're going to be disappointed. I also don't have a structured lecture put together. I want to present some thoughts and ideas. I want to give you a few things to think about, and I hope we can maybe just have a discussion. I hope you'll interrupt, you'll jump in, ask questions or whatever as we go along. What I want to present and talk about a little bit when we talk about rational thinking, responsible feeling, is some of the material, probably much of the material that I'm going to provide has been written a lot about by a fellow named Albert Ellis, and it's often called RET or Rational Emotive Therapy. Albert Ellis is a psychologist in New York. He's the person who's probably done the most work in dealing with rational thinking, rational therapy, and so forth. But he immediately, in some of his books, gives credit to some of the ancient Greek philosophers and bases most of his whole approach on the, I don't know if it was Aristotle or Socrates or whoever it was who said, man is not ruled by his life experiences, but rather by the interpretations he makes of those experiences. And I think we'll explain that a little bit as we go along. One of the things I guess I want to start out with is my artwork and try to impress you with what an artist I am. Show you that one difference or one important differentiation for us to think about is that there are at least two separate functions in the human being, in the person, and I think most of us know that. That is that most of us think, and we talk about our thinking as a process that happens in our mind. The mental thinking process is something that involves things such as mathematical calculations and formulating sentences and memory and impressions and assumptions and all those kinds of things. We also talk about emotions or feelings. And we all feel. Now, the human potential movement the last 15, 20 years has tended to identify feelings with the stomach, the viscera, the main part of your body. And I probably shouldn't pound on my microphone. And so when we talk about feelings or emotions, often it gets identified with this part of the human body. For many people, the difference between what you think and how you feel isn't always clear. And I usually try to start here because it's, I think, a very important differentiation to make. A lot of times, if you listen closely, you'll hear people say that I feel like the thing to do this afternoon is to go play volleyball before supper and then eat. Now, is there anything wrong with that statement? Sure. That's a thought. There is no feeling whatsoever expressed in that impression, that projection of what might be the best thing for them to do. I hear other people say, I think I'm really guilty for having said that and done what I did. Sure. That's a feeling. But what happens is that they say they think and then tell you a feel, or they say I feel and they tell you a think. And the probably the most prevalent mismatch in those is that recently it's the big thing is to say, I feel I'm this, and to be open and honest. And so everybody prefaces their statements with, I feel, and then they just tell you whatever they want to. The difficulty is that it gets all confused and mixed up. And lots of times when people say, I feel, they don't tell you any feeling at all. They don't share any emotion or feeling. Now, I'd like to ask, how many people here have ever had somebody say something to you and what they said made you feel angry, guilty, sad, put down? Has anybody had that experience? How many people here have ever said something to somebody else and hurt their feelings? Has anybody not ever done that? You've never done that. Good, good. We need somebody else. I guess what I'm also wondering is how many people here have ever been to a movie or a play where you're all watching, or even been sitting home watching a video of some sort, where you're all watching the same thing as a group, and somebody over here is crying, someone else over here is bored to death, and someone else over there is giggling because they think it's silly and hilarious. Anybody, or some alteration of that? Anybody experience that? Okay, does anybody know how that happens? Or why?
Different interpretations of the same event.
That's right. Everybody sees it differently. Everybody looks at it differently. Everybody interprets it differently. This is basically what Ellis is talking about. His approach or his way of trying to understand the whole process of thinking and feeling and how they all work together deals with that exact basic theorem. What he says is, it's very simple. He says there are certain actions that happen in life. And basically he'll tell you that life is a constant stream of activity and actions that are approaching you. And even while you're sleeping and not consciously aware, there's still things happening. As a result of the actions that happen in life, each of us have beliefs, thoughts, ways of interpreting, putting meaning into or deciding what this is all about. Now, some of these beliefs we automatically, kind of not even knowing, generate. They just pop up into our heads as a result of having had experiences in the past. Many of those are things that might be called very early childhood experiences. They're called private logic. Sometimes they're called common sense. And one way of looking at it is they are pre-programmed computer ways of interpreting in our mind what life is all about. Now, it might be important to differentiate that by beliefs here, I'm not necessarily talking about religious faith beliefs. I'm more talking about ways of understanding and interpreting what life means. Then what he says is that as a result of these beliefs, we all have emotional consequences. Now, I think he picks consequences simply because it fits into ABC. He's really talking about we all develop feelings. Emotional feelings. Let me give you an example. My favorite example when I talk about this is when I was growing up, and it looks like some of us are old enough to remember Jackie Gleason when he was on television. Anybody remember him? Now, this is before the Honeymooners. Way back. Some of us real old people remember when it was the Jackie Gleason show on Saturday nights about 6 o'clock. And he used to do a lot of different character sketches. One of them had Crazy Guggenheim in the bar and he'd sing. And sure, some people remember that. One of the characters he used to play was called the Poor Soul. What do you remember, the Poor Soul? You do. Thank you, Paul.
Also remember Reggie Vaughn.
Yes, right. That's another one. Anyway, this was basically an experience where the action, in this case, was the television. Now, my father and I would sit and we'd watch this show, and Gleason would play this character called the Poor Soul. And he was a large fellow and he wore a tweed leisure suit. And he would always be involved in situations where he was kind of getting walked on. Some of the ones I remember were Gleason acting like the shy, timid character that he was trying to portray, walking through the park, sitting down at a bench, trying to get his lunch bag open. He'd have trouble with that. He'd set his sandwich down. He'd be trying to open something else and he'd drop it. Someone would come and sit on his sandwich and he'd just, you know, kind of look and what can you do? And anyway, he'd go on and on, and things that just kept on happening and happening and happening. And as he got up, of course, there'd be paint all over his back. It was a fresh, you know, just thing after thing after thing would happen. Now, I recall my father would watch this action, and he would think, now this is slapstick comedy. This is acted very well. It's done by a good comedian, and the guy really gets into his role. And so he would think that it's supposed to be done that way, and what do you think he might feel as a consequence? Anybody know? Sure. He'd feel amused, humored, and he'd sit over here and laugh. I even remember him laughing so hard at times he'd hold his stomach and fall on his knees on the floor, out of the chair. He'd just really get into it. I would sit here and I'd watch that character happening, being portrayed one thing after another. Everything went wrong. You always get the short end of the stick. Never had a lucky break. He was always getting shafted. No matter where he turned, he was getting stepped on and getting screwed, you know. And I would feel sorry for the guy. And I would cry. And I distinctly, at 9 or 10 years old, remember sitting here crying, feeling sorry for this poor character and looking at this flipped out father sitting next to me, laughing, rolling around on the floor. Now, most of you said, you've said something to somebody and you made them feel hurt, sad, put down, angry, or you've said something and hurt somebody else's feelings. Does that fit here? Did the TV make him laugh? Did the TV make me cry? What did? Sure. The action up here was not the significant factor in the emotions that the two of us ended up having. The major thing that was all important was the way in which each of us interpreted, according to the beliefs that we had, of what the action meant. Now, there were times after talking to this guy and trying to figure out how he looked at it that I did think about it this way, and I did laugh. I didn't cry at every one of them. There were times when I changed what I thought about it and ended up having different feelings and emotions as a result. Now, Ellis's approach is saying that it's not the TV that has me feeling sad or him laughing. It's the way we interpret it. Now, if we take that a little further, then I think we also have to say it isn't anybody else or anything else in the world that makes you feel sad or hurt or angry or whatever. It's you, based on how you interpret everything that happens in life. And you can say things and do things in life to other people or to groups or whatever, but you do not control how they're going to feel. You cannot hurt somebody else's feelings. You cannot make someone else angry. You cannot make somebody feel put down or sad or rejected unless you can control their mind and dictate what they will believe about what you said. And that doesn't happen for any of us. What Ellis is saying is that every individual person, because we choose what to interpret about what happens in life, is the one who's responsible for their own emotions and feelings. So if somebody says something and all of a sudden I feel real angry or very sad about it, I need to take responsibility for the fact that it's not what they said or did that made me feel. It's the way I see or interpret and choose to believe what it means about what they said or did. Am I leaving people behind? Are you with me? Or okay, the other aspect I think of this whole approach is that I am not responsible and neither are you responsible for what other people feel. Only they are responsible for what they feel. Now, I'm not saying, and don't push this like often happens, way out, that I'm not going to be responsible for what I say or do. I'm going to face, and we're all going to live with the consequences of what we say or do. What I am saying is that none of us have control over other people's feelings or emotions. We only have control over our own. And nobody else has control over our feelings and emotions, only you have control over your own.
Then you're saying that you're responsible for your beliefs, and I think the person is always responsible for his own beliefs. I think they're kind of imprinted upon you. Not all of them, some of them.
Well, okay, her statement was, I'm saying then that you're responsible for your beliefs and you don't believe everybody's responsible for all their beliefs. Okay, would you explain that a little bit more, why you think people aren't responsible for all their beliefs?
Because, you know, I have a number of beliefs that I hold that I'm not really sure where they came from. And
why do you choose to continue to hold them?
Well, because they've really not been questioned. They don't bother me too much. They won't be questioned.
Okay. Are you choosing not to question them?
Unless I'm bored, yeah.
Okay.
Because they fit.
So choosing not to question them, but just to hang on to them in an unquestioned, accepted way, is something that you've chosen to do, and therefore you're living with the consequence of that.
So you're saying I would be responsible no matter how it came out.
Certainly. Because you got up today and chose not to question your belief in the Trinity of God, you're responsible for having that belief today.
That's an awful lot of you sitting around questioning everything you couldn't do anything.
I'm not talking about the fact that you're obligated to do all that work all the time. I'm simply talking about the fact that I think you're responsible for what you have, what you hold on to, and what you feel.
What about an environmental situation that someone can't get up? A child in an abuse situation, something like that.
Okay, but the question is, what about an environmental situation that a person can't help?
Well, can't be released from on a daily basis.
Okay.
Which affects his belief.
Can you give us an example that's a little more specific we can handle?
Well, maybe like a child abuse situation. You know, where a child can't break away from that environment, and he grows up in it, and responds accordingly.
Look at me, Dad.
Okay. Example for the tape was, what about a child abuse situation where the child... It's really dependent on that situation and can't get away, can't get out of it, and they grow up accordingly.
Well, I guess I may be confused about belief. Mm-hmm. I think that children could be in a situation where, if you want to take the abuse side of it, where somebody would grow up believing that the way they as an adult then react towards children would be in what we would consider an abusive case.
Yeah.
So where does that... So the action taken upon them developed a belief that they're, it seems, are not responsible for.
Well, okay. The situation is, what if you have a child growing up in a physically abusive situation? I added physical. And they, as they mature and become an adult, then become physically abusive because that's the way they learned to treat children. Okay. The difficulty with that is, of course, that there are people that have grown up to become adults out of physically abusive environments that would never touch a child because they know that they were beaten and they never want that to happen to their kids. Mm-hmm. There are people that have grown out of those environments that might, but try not to, but sometimes lose it. I don't think a situation like that will dictate how that person is going to grow up. That every person in that kind of an environment is going to interpret meaning out of that environment and create beliefs along the way according to how they see it, according to the way they try to sort it all out. And you can have 100 kids growing up in physically abusive environments and come out with 100 different ways of interpreting what that meant.
Most people tend to have a belief that if somebody hits you, aren't there some actions, there's some psychological test too where there's a man, it's a pencil drawing or something, there's a man and there's a woman laying on a bed and they're absolutely both exhausted and you're supposed to give your interpretation of this picture. I know.
And we all know it's because they just came back from Lamon Lake, right?
Well, you know, I mean, the picture itself is very, very difficult to put a positive interpretation on. I mean, you'd have to work real hard. Aren't there some actions in some situations which tend to come out with a fairly common feeling as a response to that kind of action?
Well, yeah.
Like the lady who's speaking about rape, I mean, many people would have a...
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is that when certain things happen to people, or in especially in relationships that you're very close, very intimate with somebody, there are behaviors or things that could be said that with a very, very high degree of predictability are going to get the same kind of feeling or reaction in that person. The thing that I'm talking about, I think, is that you said those things tend to get that kind of reaction. And I believe they have a high degree of predictability that someone may feel or react in a certain way. But that's different than direct control. That if you sit 1,000 people down in front of the same picture, you may get 920 the same choices out of so many. But that doesn't control their choice. It just gives you a degree of predictability of how people may react. And seeing the picture doesn't control what they're going to feel or think.
Is that the same with the subliminal suggestions then that people have been experimenting with, where you are stimulating the subconscious to get a certain reaction or belief in this case?
Well,
the only thing I think of is they've been experimenting with that in retail, where you have this music going on, you've got subliminal suggestions on either not to steal or to buy something or work harder or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that would not be an action that would develop a belief? Or an action that maybe that's just creating another action?
Yeah, I tend to believe that's more attempts to make use of general social beliefs that many people adhere to and will respond to. It doesn't say that those kinds of subliminal attempts control people's behavior. Right. I mean, there's the whole concept of muzak. You know, the background music that's supposed to... I know when I was in college working summers, the music in the morning was fairly lively, and you know, and then in the afternoon when you were tired, they'd try to speed it up to get you working, all this sort of stuff. I just, you know, my reaction to music right now is turn this stuff off. I just hate it. And it's very irritating, but other people like it. And so I think what I'm saying is music doesn't force a reaction like a cause and effect situation.
They're just predicting what the majority outcome is going to be. They have statistics.
Sure. And they're just going with the odds. But that's different than being in control of the behavior. Al?
I'm not sure I'm disagreeing with the precise point you're making, but I'm wondering about its significance. Let me try to put it this way. I don't think you can control how your action is going to be received, but I think you, through probabilities, have an awfully good idea about it. To take your illustration of the Jackie Gleason show and to take Madison Avenue advertisers, the producer and director of that show, I think, thinks he controls the way in which Jackie Gleason's poor soul routine is going to go over. The 10-year-old child is not part of the intended audience. Humor is very difficult to explain. Actually, the 10-year-old's reaction is the rational reaction to the poor soul. The adult's reaction
I like
falling
to believe
off
that.
His chair is not the rational reaction to somebody who's suffering in a situation that's adverse. But humor is tough. Why do we laugh at things? It's incongruity and a lot of things like that. Try to explain it. But the fact remains, the Jackie Gleason show would be off the air in a big hurry if most of the people didn't laugh at that routine. And I think the producers of that show know with a high degree of probability that people are going to laugh. I think they think they're controlling the reaction by the action that they put over the tube.
And they probably need to believe that they're controlling in order to continue doing what they're doing.
But now, what's your point in when you say they don't, really?
Well, okay, what... Maybe I need to go on then. I guess the point I'm making is that the focus here is the emotions and feelings that we live with. And an offshoot of that, the relationships that we live with in other people. The feelings that we have need some mode, some method of being dealt with or resolved. And for a lot of people, many people who believe that somebody else makes them feel, they're caught in this trap then that says, my husband's coming home drunk every Friday night, and his coming home drunk makes me so angry I could kill him. The only way to quit being so angry that I could kill him is to control his behavior so he doesn't come home drunk every night. The only way to change my feeling is to change that action. Which again then puts, like in my example, puts family members in the role of trying to control and manipulate other people's behavior as a way of altering their emotional reactions. And of course, in that example, that's a guaranteed failure. There's no way you're going to control an alcoholic. It's also a setup, if you believe that the outside world controls your emotions, it's a setup to fail to try and make that change. Because how many of us have been successful in controlling the outside world exactly the way we want it? It just doesn't go that way. I guess what I'm saying is that I think, what Ellis is saying is that the process is in working and dealing with your emotions, you can continue on yourself through rationalizing and working with the belief systems you have to help you resolve emotional feelings that are very painful and destructive and aren't necessarily healthy for you. Let me go on and give you an example. The one that Ellis often uses is anger. And that's a little bit of what we're going to talk about tomorrow in my presentation on anger. What he's saying is that if you're feeling a lot of anger, or you're really angry about somebody or something, his theory or approach says that your anger, I don't want to say too much of this because I'm going to use it tomorrow, your anger is the consequence of thinking irrationally. Ellis's approach says that all anger is based on irrational thoughts. For example, two of the dirtiest words in the English language for Albert Ellis are should and ought. Basically says they ought to be thrown out. Should and shouldn't, ought and not, ought not, are crazy and only cause people trouble. Now, I guess a way to explain that is I recall a couple years ago, one morning early, it was the last day of school, and I was out running in town, and it was a day like today, it was very hot, so all I had was a pair of shorts on and my shoes, and I went running by the middle school in town. All the buses were lining up and they were unloading the kids. And some middle school student leaned out the window of the bus with a squirt gun and went zap, 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 about four times and nailed me with water. My immediate reaction that I was aware of was to be angry for getting squirted in the face by some seventh grader. Now, why would I be angry by getting squirted in the face by some seventh grader? Well, this process says that you can work with those kinds of angry feelings, those kinds of destructive emotions, by disputing your irrational beliefs. So as I kept on running, I tried to work out this process, and I realized, okay, I'm mad at this kid for squirting me. What am I thinking about what he did that isn't rational, that's nuts, that's crazy? And I went back and sorted out and asked myself, what am I thinking about his behavior? And I realized I immediately was saying, what? He shouldn't have scored me. Seventh graders shouldn't treat adults disrespectfully.
What if it's an action that is, like, suppose my daughter got a hold of a book of math and went out and started a fire here, which makes very many people angry.
I think fright would probably be a...
anger, fright. I mean, that's an action which that should not...
No.
Should not
let me get on to that.
We'll
jump to that one. What I was saying was he shouldn't have done that. Now, what's crazy about thinking he shouldn't have done that? Well, that happened about four more buses down the lane. It felt very good to get cold water.
But the key part that he shouldn't have done that to me.
Yeah.
I mean, if you observed him doing that to somebody else, you might have experienced a different emotion. The fact that he indeed swore to you, I'm
shouldn't have done it to me.
Your shoes.
You're right. Okay. What did you say?
It's already been done.
You're right. To say he shouldn't have done that is to deny what just happened shouldn't have happened. I mean, it's crazy to say that my life experience 2 seconds ago shouldn't have been my life experience 2 seconds ago.
Where's there been a bullet in that car?
Well, that's anyone can see.
Okay, I'm starting out simple and getting more complex. It's simple to talk about getting squirted with water and say he shouldn't have done that because, first of all, it's denial of reality to say he shouldn't have because he did. And that's irrational to talk about what did happen in life as the fact that it shouldn't have happened. The other part of it is that he's perfectly free to choose to behave whatever way he chooses to behave. And for me to say he shouldn't have done that or he should have done this differently is for me to say that he's supposed to live his life according to the way I want him to live it, according to my rules or according to my laws or expectations. And where is there that it says that that person's supposed to live their life according to my expectations and rules?
If you push this far enough, then what expectations can anyone have of anything? Doesn't one simply end up in a sort of quasi-Hindu sort of situation where what is, always is, always has been, always will be, and one simply goes along with the flow of irrational Maya, which is no more rational than what's being attempted up here, it seems to be. Because he could have done more than squirt you with water. He could have thrown something and cut off your leg with something sharp.
Or he could have had a gun and shot me with a bullet.
Well, with a bullet, maybe you couldn't feel anything afterwards. But with a leg sheared off, you probably still could have some sort of feeling.
Sure. Or with a forest fire that might have started here because her daughter played with some matches down here.
I don't see what's irrational, for example. About this whole situation here. It seems to me that it's quite rational for me to want to protect what is the current reality of my life at this point. It seems to me that that's one thing that all creatures have in common. Mm-hmm. You want to protect what's there. So I don't see it as an irrational response. But that should not have happened. My space should not have been invaded in that way. I'm not denying that it happened. It certainly happened. But it seems to me it's a rational response to realize that my entire existence was there in danger, that it was put in mortal jeopardy. If we're going beyond here, squirting with them. In fact, even squirting, if you were jogging, I could have put you in mortal jeopardy. But that hit you in the eye.
Okay. I think what you're talking about are two different things. I think some people say that shouldn't have happened and then get all bent out of shape because it did. And I think other people look at that situation and say, that did happen, I wish it hadn't have happened. But I need to accept the fact that it did and learn to live with it rather than fight the fact that it shouldn't have.
Well, the fact is that you, a person, became angry because of what you're saying is a belief, and I think basically had an issue then is how do you deal with that anger? You know, how do you deal with that emotion, that feeling? Do you deal with it constructively or destructively? Because, you know, it's true that, you know, we own our own feelings, and to a certain extent, we can't control those. That, you know, I mean, we can't say, I'm going to, at least not in a healthy manner, say, I'm not going to be angry. You know, that gives us a stomach ache for a whole bunch of other things. But then recognizing that we have anger, and then asking ourselves, how are we going to deal with that?
Yeah.
You know, if I could take another example, one I've used myself is, you know, when a Coke machine takes 50 cents, you know, you can deal with a whole number of ways, some constructive, some destructive. You can bang on the machine until you get 50 cents for the glass out of it, or you can go to the person that manages the store and say, machine, take me 50 cents, I'll get 50 cents back.
Mm-hmm. Or you
maybe I'm getting ahead of you here, but that really doesn't
come
to issue.
Sure.
How you handle
it. I think what you're saying is that there are a lot of different ways to believe or interpret what that machine or what happened in that experience or that interchange with the machine. And that the way you interpret it, the meaning you put into that experience, is going to dictate what emotional reaction you're going to have. Now, the person that takes their 50 cents and says, I know I've got this, and I know that's a machine, and if I put this money into that machine, there's a gamble that I may get pop and I may not get pop. Well, I'm a gambling man, let's try it. Then you throw your 50 cents in and you don't get it, and you say, well, I lost. That's the gamble. Is going to have a different emotional reaction than the guy who expects pop every time it comes out, and when he doesn't, he's getting ripped off and pounds on the machine.
What about the feeling of humor? You have feelings there. To me, if I was an outsider and saw a young boy support you, you were in a jogging outfit, you were real hot and everything, and I saw this happen, to me, that was that.
Sure.
Well, have the feeling of laughter?
See, what happened in my experience was that I immediately felt angry. I said, I want to sort this out. Why? What am I thinking? I realized I was saying he shouldn't have done that, and I was trying to impose my so-called adult rules on his behavior. And I then realized, I asked myself, why shouldn't he have done that? He did it. And I need to accept the fact he did it. I maybe wish he hadn't have done it, but he did. And who am I to get my way in life? Life never has given me just what I want, when I want it, as fast as I want it anyway, and it never will. And at that point I realized, well, he did it. I might as well accept it. I might as well begin to live with it rather than try to deny he did or get mad because he did. And of course then at that point, cold water started feeling cool on my body, and I started to laugh about it because it felt nice then, and I realized it was nuts and crazy to think that.
So you just went through a series of steps of somewhat rationalization.
Right. I went back and challenged or disputed this belief I had about why shouldn't a seventh grader squirt me with water?
Well,
just because I don't want
to. Them at school, and maybe nothing should be thrown out of windows and buses. And maybe you should write to the principal and say, I would like to report some behavior which I felt was very poor the other day. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could even stop that kind of thing occurring. Depending on how angry you are and what you want to do about what happened to you.
Yeah. Well, what happened was...
Well, you didn't want to accept it. Say, well, I guess it was good after all.
That's the way it ended up was. I was about ready to turn around and go back and say, would you get me again? It felt really...
It could have been ink. It could have been ammonia.
That's right. And if... And I, what I'm saying is that if in going back and looking at what I believed about that situation, it would have been a lot more serious, like a bullet or like a forest fire. There would have been other things that I would have done. There would have been other consequences that would have happened. But I would have gone back, and if it had been a bullet, and he would have shot me in the leg, for example. You know, at that point, there wouldn't have been much I could have done other than to make certain that the legal consequences that our society has already established were, the process was carried out. And I would have participated in that to the fullest extent. But I don't think it would have benefited the child or myself, my own mental health, to say that he shouldn't have done it, because he already did. It's not what I would have liked him to have done, but he did it anyway, and it's a real disappointing, unfortunate situation, but I'd better learn to cope with it and live with it and accept it as it was, rather than to say it shouldn't have happened, and get really bent out of shape about it.
Yeah, but I can't quite get your hair splitting here. If we don't have certain beliefs and share those, we can't live together. We got to teach the kids to do certain things and hold certain beliefs, or we're going to have chaos. And it's very nice that you're able to rationally evaluate actions taken as far as seriousness goes. But that's it. Somewhere you have to draw the line, and I think you're throwing a baby out with the bathwater here. We're just going to dip down here to angry and irrationality. Because somewhere you've got to say, this could be serious and it should be brought to somebody's attention.
But that's different than...
Even though it feels good. I mean, maybe next time you run by, the guy says, gee, you like the water, maybe you'll like, apples.
Mm-hmm. Somebody help me out. I'm confused about what you're saying.
You're talking about you dealing with your own feelings, and I think you're talking about dealing with what could happen, or dealing with the situation as a whole. And I think saying to yourself, it's no good for me to be angry and to tell this kid that this shouldn't have happened, that I agree with that. Yeah. But that doesn't mean you can't say, but don't do it again, or here's what happened, look what the consequences were of your actions. It's different to say, I'm not going to be angry just because it shouldn't have happened. And that doesn't mean you can't say, don't let it happen again, or let's not let this happen again.
Yeah. I think you started saying that you can't push this too far to say that individuals are not responsible for their own actions. So it seems to me that what you're talking about is coping with your own personal reactions and owning your own feelings about the situation.
Sure.
Not saying that individual is not responsible for their action, and they might have some consequences in law or consequences that they're going to have to live with or whatever. But you have to live with the only way you feel about it for the rest of your life. If something's already happened, you got to feel about it.
But the fellow who's writing this is saying that these are two dirty words, and I'm saying that in the big picture, they can't be dirty words, because we can't live together in groups.
And I don't disagree with that at all. I'm saying that in the big picture, we have laws, we have a legal system, we have consequences, and I'm 100% behind our living with that, and living within that. But what I'm saying is that it can drive you crazy to be angry at the guy who robbed your house if you continue to say he shouldn't have done it when he did it. And he got arrested, and he's in prison. To continue saying, he shouldn't have done that to me, he shouldn't have done that to me,
two nights ago, I met a guy here that I haven't seen for 25 years, and he recounted an experience that we had 30 years ago when we were freshmen in college. And he kept saying, gosh, this guy shouldn't have pulled me around the waist because he cracked my ribs, and I could have been. And in essence, what he was saying is, that shouldn't have happened to me. And he was denying that indeed I did and he didn't.
Yeah.
In essence. And I think that's what you're talking about.
And what's been the emotional consequence for that guy for 30 years?
And I, he's been waiting a long time to tell me. And quite frankly, I told him, I just assume kind of live more in the present, think about whatever like that was that you talked about getting tired and going to. and not worry about the tired times 30 years ago.
Yeah.
That's where I was with it. Now, I can't account for my anger about that.
Well, are you saying anything more than when norms of conduct are violated, it doesn't do much good just to feel rage about it? That the feeling of rage is going to get in the way of perhaps doing something constructive, either to deter the individual or to deter others from violating that same norm of conduct. What I found difficult in your presentation was when you said that these words are irrational, that he should not have done it, that denies reality. That doesn't deny reality, the fact that he should not have done it. You're just calling attention to a norm of conduct which was violated. And I thought I heard you say that, why should he conform to my expectations? Well, I would hope that the norm of conduct about not shooting water or gun or bullets or anything at someone else is not just a feeling on your part, that has society's backing in the sense that we don't think people should do things like that.
But is it rational to expect the world to turn out perfectly in every instance?
No, but it's rational to do whatever one can to bring the offender to justice, or to do that which is needed to reform the situation.
Yeah, but are we talking about moral beliefs and ethics, or are we talking about dealing with our emotions?
Yeah, you guys are blowing this out into a global concept, and I'm dealing with it internally as a person in their ability to cope and deal with emotionally according to what's healthy for you as an individual. Now, I don't disagree at all that we've got rules, and society says if you break the rules, these will be the consequences. That's not the issue. The issue is, the guy breaks the rules, it's not going to help you to say he shouldn't have broken the rules. It's going to leave you all emotionally distraught, bent out of shape to say what he did shouldn't have happened. The prime example for me was that our house was burglarized. We were gone for the weekend. We came home, it was a ransacked mess. My wife and I had two totally different reactions. She said those people shouldn't have broken into my house and violated my space and messed up my house. And I looked at the situation and said, thank God they didn't destroy this place, and all they did was steal a few things that are insured already anyway, and we're getting kind of old, and now I can get a new tape recorder. And thank God my kids weren't hurt. And thank God they didn't come in at night and burn the place down or something.
Is one reaction more rational than the other? They both sound
I think what Ellis is saying is that it's crazy for my wife to say those guys shouldn't have done that.
Why?
Because that's their profession, that's how they live, that's the way they live, that's how they make their living.
And it's crazy depending on how she acts. If she's going to sit and do what the fellow that you talked about did for 30 years and keep going over it, I might admit that that's crazy. However, if because she's convinced that people shouldn't do things like that, she perhaps gets onto some kind of a community watchdog committee or something, and there may be some social result. What's crazy about that?
Let me ask, why shouldn't people do things like that?
Why shouldn't people do things like what? Like breaking into a house?
Yeah.
I have to tell you that?
Yeah.
Do you feel that there's some sacred space around
that? Wait a minute, now you're avoiding answering my question. Why shouldn't somebody who is a professional house burglar and lives on stealing not do that?
Why should someone not do that? Mm-hmm. Someone should not do that because it is violating the rights of other people.
Yep.
It's invading their humanity. It is threatening their life.
Why shouldn't somebody have the freedom to do that if they wish?
Why shouldn't someone have the freedom to do that?
Right.
Well, they do have the freedom sometimes.
Right. So what are you saying that they shouldn't?
They
shouldn't takes away their freedom to choose.
Whose freedom to choose?
That guy's freedom to choose to break the law.
That's right. We obviously don't have complete freedom.
Yes, we do.
No, we don't. He broke the law.
He did it.
I think there's a difference between freedom and license.
Well, I'm not condoning what he did, but I'm also saying that he's got the freedom to do it.
Now he's got the power to do it, the license. Not
I really think that she's advocating some basic moral norms when you talk to her.
I'm not advocating the norms. I'm recognizing the fact that he has the freedom to break the rules. I mean, we don't live in a society that he has the choice.
You don't know that he has a choice that much. You know, why do you think that you chose, you know, when you went through the thing with the water gun, how you reacted? Mm-hmm. I get the impression that you feel you were in control of that because you went through this rational cogitation. Why do you feel that you were any more in control by doing that than had you simply run after the guy and beaten up on him? Why was that more controlled, and why were you more in control of the situation by reacting in this way than if you had reacted in another way? What is it that went into your experience that turned you out to be person A rather than person B, so that you reacted in A way rather than B way?
I know that
you
one.
You think you're much more in control.
I was told when I was a child that good Christian boys don't do this, and nice children behave that way, and these are the rules, and this is how you respect your elders. Sure, I know where I picked those beliefs up. But I never took a look at them to see whether they were hurting me or helping me.
Now I'm talking about your controlled cogitation when you thought over what the young man did when he squirted you. And the impression that I'm getting is that you feel you were really in control of that situation. You chose to react that way. I would suspect that there's been a lot of training that's gone on that brought you to that situation. And I don't know whether one is any more in control than if one had just gone running after him. I think life is much more paradoxical. I think we're both in control and not in control at the same time.
I think there's two separate issues there, though, the shouldn't-ought issue and the reactive issue of what you do with the situation are separate issues.
That's right. That's right. But another problem that I feel here today is that we try to keep issues too separate. It appears to me that all of these are on continua. Thinking and feeling are not separate. They're continuous. And inner and outer are not separate. They are also continuous. What happens to me personally on the inside as I'm dealing with my feelings is in continuity with what I do in concert with others on the outside. Because part of myself is my social self, not just my little interpersonal self.
You know, if I need help, I go to him, not to you. And I don't mean that to be rude, but what he's talking about is something I can deal with very practically in my own relationship. And you're dealing with kind of a fuzzy area for me that I wouldn't find very practical in my own real life. Do you understand what I mean?
No, because one of the things that my wife and I found out is that when we live close to a student dormitory at residence hall, where there's incredible amounts of noise and racket, one possible way that we could deal with it would be to go into deep meditation and constantly tell ourselves, well, they have the freedom to make the noise. All right, let me tell you. They have the freedom to make the noise. Our problem is to change our feelings so we're not angry. Another way that we can go at it, however, is to get involved in residence life and get involved in local control in the community and see that some laws are put in effect so they can't do it.
What you were saying just wouldn't help.
Calling an official conclusion, and anybody that wants to continue on can continue on.